Bibles this evening and turn to the book of Ecclesiastes, the book of Ecclesiastes. Before we begin here, let me just mention that we have had to postpone our marriage retreat. Now, those of you who were signed up, you should have gotten an email with a little bit more elaboration on that. I hope you did, but we just want to make sure. It turns out that some of the Barry children were manifesting symptoms very likely associated with COVID-19, not certain on that, but very possibly. And so in the interest of caution, we opted to not go forward with the conference this weekend. And I'm sad about that because I was very much looking forward to it. But thankfully, the Barry schedule right now is such that they anticipate being in the States for a while, because at this particular point in time, the Philippines is closed to Americans, closed to many, many people. In fact, Brother Tim said that the one thing they were talking about is maybe they would, after the first of the year, open it up to fiancés. You know, so they're taking a pretty narrow view. So we were able to reschedule our marriage retreat, or our marriage conference, for the first weekend in February, at least tentatively so. We'll finalize that in the next day or so, but that's our tentative plan. And so for those of you who are planning to come, I'm sorry we won't be able to do it this weekend, but I hope that you will make plans to be here that particular weekend. And maybe you weren't able to come this weekend, and you will be then. So we're just trusting that the Lord will use this in a great way. Do be in prayer for the Barry kids, and just for God's health and protection and care for them. Mom and Dad had the virus previously, so Lord willing, that means that they aren't going to have to deal with it themselves, but still with their kids. So just be praying for them. Well, let me begin this evening by delving into an arena of knowledge that I don't know much about. This is actually Pastor Micah's thing, kind of, so to speak. Major League Baseball, okay? 2 years ago today, in a divisional playoff game against the Dodgers, Atlanta Braves rookie outfielder Ronald Acuna Jr. hit a grand slam home run. Now, hitting a grand slam home run is a pretty big deal in and of itself, but what made this one an even bigger deal was that Acuna became the youngest player in Major League Baseball history to hit a grand slam in the postseason. He was 20 years old. Now, the previous record had been set in 1953 by a switch-hitting player who would later be inducted into the Hall of Fame. Pastor Paul, you know who that is, right? Mickey Mantle, all right? This shows Mantle hitting that grand slam in the 1953 World Series at the age of 21 years old. So Ronald Acuna was a little bit more than a year younger when he set this record. Well, in a post-game interview, a reporter from The Athletic asked Acuna if he knew he had broken Mickey Mantle's record. And Acuna's response was, in essence, "Who's that? I've never heard of him." And when he was told it happened in 1953, he said, "Well, I wasn't even born yet." That, folks, is how life works. And that really illustrates perfectly one of the unsettling observations made by Solomon in the book of Ecclesiastes. And the essence of it is this: you're going to die, and you're going to be forgotten. Mickey Mantle died in 1995. And he's already been forgotten by at least some, including someone whose life is all about baseball. That's what Solomon is saying to us in Ecclesiastes chapter 1 and verse 11. He says, "There's no remembrance of the former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those that shall come after." So he's saying, you know what? Things that have happened in the past, they're going to be forgotten. Things that are going to happen in the future, well, they're going to eventually be forgotten by even people who come after them. You're going to die, and you're going to be forgotten. You say, "Wow, Pastor, what an encouraging thought." You know, that verse, no doubt, must be surrounded by others in the book of Ecclesiastes that are more positive and uplifting, to which I would say, well, not really. Not really. Look at verse 2. "Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity." Tonight we are beginning a study in the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is one of the five so-called wisdom books in the Old Testament. The others are Job and the Psalms and Proverbs and Song of Solomon. And this book of Ecclesiastes is an intriguing book. It is an unsettling book. It is a sometimes confusing book. And that fits with the opening words you see there on the screen. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What in the world does that mean? What in the world is Solomon's point when he says that? I debated for a long time with myself how to start this study. You know, there's kind of the typical commentary view where you talk about background and maybe the significance of Solomon as the author, even the debate about whether Solomon really is the author. I think he is. You'll be able to tell that because I'll mention his name probably about 50 times tonight, okay? And at some point, we will talk about some of those things, you know? And then in the verse 1, he refers to himself as the preacher. And you say, what in the world does that mean? And why is this book called Ecclesiastes anyway? Doesn't that word mean church? You know, he's writing in the Old Testament. So there's all these questions before we even get started, but I'm going to just let those questions before we get started wait until after we're started. And tonight what I want us to do is just really jump in and look at the opening section, the opening poem, really. The first 11 verses are a poem written in that regard and kind of grapple with what they have to say for us. So let's take a look here, Ecclesiastes chapter 1, beginning in verse 1. Now, as I read this tonight, I'm going to do so without the Old English endings, okay? Without the "ths" at the end of the verbs. So just, you know, be patient with me as I do that. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanities. What profit has a man of all his labor which he labors under the sun? One generation passes away, and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. It just keeps on going. The sun also rises, and the sun goes down and hastens to his place where he arose. The wind goes towards the south and then turns about unto the north. It whirls about continually, and the wind returns again according to his circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, to there they return again. All things are full of labor, man cannot utter it. Full of weariness really is the idea. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. The thing that has been, it is that which shall be. And that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new? Of course, the implied answer is no. It has already been of old time, which was before us. There is no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those that shall come after. Let's have a word of prayer here as we begin. Father, we are thankful for your word. I'm thankful for this book. It's a challenge to me. I trust it'll be a challenge to all of us as we study it. Part of that challenge is just sorting out the essence of it, the meaning behind some of these enigmatic statements. But also the challenge there is to live under the instruction that Solomon gives to us. And I pray, Father, that while there are certainly interesting things that we'll talk about tonight and throughout this study, that we would not just be captured by interest, but that our hearts would be open and sensitive and eager to allow the wisdom of this book to shape our thinking, to adjust our outlook, to change how we view life. Pray for your blessing on this time. I pray that you would guide my thoughts and words. I pray that you would open the understanding and hearts of these your people. I pray, Father, that you would be honored, that you would be upheld as we spend this time in your word, and that we would be changed. I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. You know, if you just look at our world's view of things, and by world, I don't mean just the fallen, I mean the unsavory world or the anti-Christian world. I mean just people. The world in a broad general sense, not a negative sense, not a positive sense, just the people that are out there, our culture, those around us, people have a natural desire for longevity and for significance in their lives. I would guess that's true of all of us. We know that if you're a Christian, if you die, you go home to be with the Lord, but we also would enjoy the opportunity to live a long life. We'd enjoy the opportunity to have our lives make a difference in the lives of others. We want to live lives that are significant, that are meaningful, that are valuable to others, that are honorable in the sight of God. So those are desires that we have. And frankly, especially maybe among young people who have not yet started experiencing the aches and pains of age, you know, people kind of want to think that they're going to live forever. And they don't like the idea of dealing with and confronting death. Probably 90% of the funerals I conduct, I reference a passage here that we will encounter in due course in the book of Ecclesiastes where Solomon says, it's better to go to a funeral than to go to a wedding. It's better to go to a place of mourning than to a place of feasting. You know, and that's kind of unsettling and it's kind of counterintuitive and it kind of runs contrary to our natural idea of let's just not think much about death, let's not talk much about death, let's not think much about suffering, let's just kind of try to put on our good face and look to the good things. And that's kind of how life works. And so when people finally come to grips with the fact that they're not going to live forever, well, then they start thinking about legacy, right? People, presidents, as their terms come to an end, talk about their legacy and what's going to be left behind. And we kind of think about those kinds of things. And our hope is that our lives will be remembered, that they'll make a difference, that when we're passed on, people will remember with fondness. You know, I'm hopeful that my sermons will live on in your hearts, right? If the Lord takes me away. Of course, the problem with that is you're all going to die too, right? I mean, that's just how it works. And that's what Solomon's saying. He's saying you are going to die, just like Mickey Mantle. And you will be forgotten. In fact, in a very short time, your accomplishments will drift from people's memories until no one remembers you. Solomon says, that's what life is like, because life is vanity. Or more accurately, life is a vapor. In fact, that's the gist of how I've entitled tonight's message. All of life is a vapor. You say, Pastor, where do you get that from our text? Well, I get it from verse 2. Do you see the word vanity? It appears 5 times in verse 2 alone, and then it appears another 33 times in the rest of the book. And I want to suggest to us folks that understanding the meaning of this one word is crucial to a proper understanding of the book of Ecclesiastes. And the Hebrew word that we're talking about is hebel. And in its basic, unaffected meaning, that's what grammarians talk about, you know, when they're saying, apart from context, right? Because I can take the word present, P-R-E-S-E-N-T, and it can have to do being in a particular place, it can have to do with a particular time, you know, different meanings based on context, but words have typically a common, a kind of a core range of meaning. And the essence of the meaning of this word hebel, its unaffected meaning, is a mist, or a wisp, or a vapor, or a breath, or maybe a bit of smoke. And the idea behind this word is it's something that's there for a moment, and then it's gone. That, folks, is what the word, what the Hebrew word, actually means. Now, this is a picture of what you should have in your mind when you encounter the word vanity those 38 times in Ecclesiastes. And whenever I use this illustration, usually from James' reference to the same idea, but, you know, I mentioned that we in the north have a distinct advantage. You know, people that live on the equator, they don't see their breath. But if you live in Chicago, from around this time of year, you know, and increasingly then in through the winter, you go out on that crisp fall morning, on that wintry cold day, and you breathe and you see that vapor, that's Hebel. That's what you're seeing. It's there, it's real, it's got substance to it, you know, but it's gone quickly. And if you try to grab it and hold on to it, guess what? You can't do it. That'd be a good exercise for a six-year-old. Take him outside and convince him to try and catch your breath, you know, whatever. But, you know, that's the essence of what Solomon is saying here. He says, life is like that vapor, like that wisp of wind. And it's there, you see it, and gone. And you can't hold on to it. Now, if life is like that, you say, okay, well, why, Pastor, does the Bible say vanity? Why doesn't it just say vapor or mist or something like that? To which I answer, good question. I wish it did. That would be, to me, a preferable way of translating it. Because I think sometimes that word vanity steers us in the wrong direction from what Solomon is getting at. We understand the English word vanity a couple different ways. First, the word implies, in our thinking oftentimes, a moral judgment. If you're familiar with Pilgrim's Progress, anybody read that or at least heard the story or somewhat familiar with it? Well, there's this place called Vanity Fair. Remember that? And Vanity Fair is a depraved carnival where people indulge in vain, immoral frivolities. So when we hear the word vanity, sometimes we think like that. A vain person is someone we understand who is conceited, someone who is maybe unduly concerned with outward appearances. I don't know whether you have one of these in your home or not, but the place, ladies, where you pretty yourself up is sometimes called a vanity, right? You know, so this word has all these different meanings, and none of those associations, frankly, are particularly helpful in getting at what Solomon means when he uses the word Hebel. When he says, Hebel of Hebels, all is Hebel, he's not saying that everything is conceited or vain or immoral. That's not his point. Now, our word vanity comes from the Latin word vanitas, which means empty. And I'm guessing that that's the idea that the translators had in mind when they chose this word, right? Because translation is an imprecise art. It's where you take a language, you're looking at the context, and you're trying to identify the best word that falls within the range of meaning translationally to use. But you got to pick one word, you know? So there's kind of a range of meaning. And so I'm thinking that the translators chose vanity with the idea of emptiness, right? That's kind of what another meaning of the word vanity. And there is a common approach to the book of Ecclesiastes. It's what I would describe as a common misconception about what Solomon's intent is. Many people view this as a book that describes the emptiness and the futility of life outside of Christ. You know, in other words, for the one who doesn't know God, everything is vanity, it's empty, it's pointless, it's meaningless, it's of no value whatsoever. The first study Bible I ever owned was a Thompson Chain Reference Bible. And I don't know if it was my wife or my pastor or whatever, but somebody very early on encouraged me that Bibles are meant to be written in. Let me just suggest that to you, okay? Your Bibles have margins for a reason, not to guard blank space, but to give you a place to write notes and annotate things and offer explanations so that the next time you're reading, that can be of help to you. It can stir up in your mind something that you've thought about profitably previously. So I began filling that Thompson Chain Reference Bible, which doesn't have very big margins because it's got all these little chain references in the margins. How dare they do that? That's why, you know, I subsequently bought a Cambridge Wide Margin Study Bible that's all about the margins and blank pages. But anyway, crammed into my margins around the book of Ecclesiastes, I had recorded these words, and I didn't remember that I had given attribution to them, but I did. These come from a Scofield reference Bible. And here's what C.I. Scofield says. Ecclesiastes describes the best conclusion that man, apart from redemption, can draw. It clearly does not anticipate the gospel. And there are a lot of people, especially in years gone by, recently things have adjusted somewhat, but who had that way of thinking. You know, Scofield is suggesting that Solomon is either lacking in wisdom, doubtful, okay, that he is really wayward and backslidden and thinking like a lost person, doubtful, or that he's intentionally writing a book for skeptics to help them confront the emptiness of life without God. Now, there are apologetic approaches that try to do that. You know, and you could read the book of Ecclesiastes, and if that's your framework, you would see it suggesting that. I mean, I get where people are coming from, and for a while, at least when I wrote that down, I bought into it and thought, okay, that makes sense. But over time and working through this book, I've come to realize that, you know, Solomon wasn't just writing a book for skeptics to say, you know, you need God. That's a valid need and a valid purpose. But he was writing a book not only for unbelievers, but for believers, for God's people. And he's writing, and here's a man who is imbued with particular wisdom from God. And he's written by, it's written by a man who had experienced really all that life had to offer. I mean, wealth, wisdom, whatever, you know, concubines. I mean, he whatever the world out there would say you could have, Solomon could have had it. And did have a lot of it. He had experienced all of those things. He had grown up under instruction from David, a man after God's own heart. So here's a man with all kinds of background resources. And he's writing not primarily to skeptics, but to God's people as we grapple with making sense out of life. And I would suggest to you that in one way, this is kind of a companion book to the book of Job. Okay, now, there may be a million reasons why that's not so, but this is just a thought that struck me even today as I was thinking about this. You know, Job tries to make sense out of life in light of all the inexplicable suffering that he endured. And you remember his friends, they said, Job, listen, you know, things go together. You know, God doesn't do this to somebody who's doing okay. You got to have problems in your life. And the book of Job grapples with, so when there are just these harsh things that befall you for no apparent reason, what do you make of that? What, when life just comes along and beats you up, how do you make sense out of that? That's what the book of Job is talking about. The book of Ecclesiastes is when things are great. How do you make sense out of that? Or when things are arbitrary, they're good one day and bad the next, how do you make sense out of that? When you're successful, how does that fit in with the framework of life? And so what Solomon is doing here is helping us understand and make sense out of life. And folks, I want to suggest that we as Christians, as believing people, need this instruction just as, I mean, the lost need to be saved, okay? But we struggle with wrong views of life and wrong views of how to interpret the realities of life and the events of life and the circumstances of life. And we even oftentimes have misconceptions about what wisdom really is. And I'll give you an illustration here. And this is probably true in one degree or another of all of us. Maybe you have this idea that, you know, I ask God for wisdom. Well, let me illustrate it this way, okay? If you've ever flown out of O'Hare, you know, you're just sitting there on the tarmac, and there's planes, yes, I mean, coming and going every which way. I mean, it's a busy intersection as airports go with high stakes. And, you know, you might be sitting there, and you're just sitting and waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting, and you're saying, come on, you know, what are, why can't we, I mean, these guys pulled out after we did, and they're already gone. Why are we sitting here? And we want to know why, and we want to figure that all out. Or you're in the air, and the pilot very calmly tells you, we're going to be circling for a while before we land, and you know that your family's down there at the gate. Well, they aren't at the gate anymore. They're baggage claim, and they're waiting for you. And you know, why can't we land? What's going on? And you want to know. And we tend to think that, you know, wisdom from God means God is going to take us into the control tower. And he's going to show us the displays. And he's going to explain to us how this works and why this plane has to go over here and why this plane has to wait and why this plane gets to go ahead of this plane and how we're going to keep everything all straight. And we think that godly wisdom means God letting us in on his understanding of all of his plans and his methods and his approaches to things. And we also think that maybe even a little bit, when we have that kind of wisdom, then we're going to be able to kind of nudge God and give him some suggestions of things that will, you know, make things, will get me on the ground a little bit sooner, will get me off the runway a little bit sooner. And we really desperately want to understand, and we desperately want to control. And I think sometimes we have this misconception that if I am spiritual enough, if I am walking closely enough with God, he's going to lift the curtain and let me see all the whys. He's going to help me understand why this person has cancer and this person doesn't. Why this person recovers from cancer and this person dies. Why this person is gifted with incredible abilities and this, and this person has severe disabilities. Why these people are married and these people who would desperately love to be married, just God never seems to bring them to that right person. Why these people who have, these people have children, these people want to have children, but they don't. You know, why this person loses their job and this person doesn't. I mean, all those whys, we think that, you know, God, couldn't you just show me that? And sometimes we mistake that for wisdom. And Solomon is teaching us here that, you know what, even as believers, life is hard to figure out. And how the circumstances weave together, we just don't know. And we're not going to know. And not only don't we know why or how it works, but we certainly are not in control. You know? And we're not going to be in control. And Solomon wants to teach us, you know what? It's okay not to be in control. And it's okay not to know. And in fact, it's okay to acknowledge that I just don't know what's going on here. This doesn't make sense to me. That's okay. Because here's what we need. We just need to trust the one who does know. And we need to trust the one who is in control. And while life may be an enigma, you know, God can be trusted. Life may be uncertain, you know, God is reliable. You know, life may be a real puzzle to us. We may feel like we're just getting smacked around left and right, and it doesn't seem fair, and it doesn't seem right, and it doesn't seem just, and yet we know that we have a righteous God, a just God, a loving God, a compassionate God, and we need to stop letting life turn us upside down and get our eyes on Him. And that's what Solomon wants to help us come to understand with an honest look at life. And so right out of the gate, he's kind of trying to just grab us by the shoulders and shake us a little bit and say, stop kidding yourself into thinking you can have this all figured out. Stop with that. Stop telling yourself that, you know, if I just get spiritual enough, it'll all make sense. Stop with that. Stop, preachers, making it sound like you've just got life by the tail and, you know, there are no surprises and you are so dogmatic on exactly how everything is going to. Stop with that. Solomon says, listen, it's all vapor. It's not all vanity, but it's all vapor. It's not empty, even if it sometimes feels that way. You know, all of life is not empty. The world's not empty. Actually, life is quite full, okay? If you disagree with that, just spend a little time with me. I constantly feel like life is kind of like overflowing from the brim. You know, and that's kind of how life is full. And life does have purpose. So when he says vanity of vanities or vapor of vapors, his point isn't to say life is meaningless, life is purposeless. You know, there's the two primary translations amongst different Bible versions of that word hebel is vanity and meaningless. And meaningless is probably an even more distracting translation than vanity. So what I want to encourage you to do when you encounter that word, just stick with what the Hebrew word means at its most basic, in its plainest sense. Vapor, mist. And life is like that. It's elusive. It's uncertain. There's another expression that Solomon uses. And if I were to translate it very, very literally, it would be chasing after the wind. You'll see this in the King James as vexation of spirit. The word spirit, wind, breath, those are the same Hebrew word. And the word vexation is actually kind of like pursuit, the struggle for, striving for. And so Solomon says repeatedly, listen, you know, your life is like a vapor, and stop thinking that you can wrap your hands around it and grab it. Stop chasing the wind. Stop striving after that which you cannot grasp, that you can't hold on to. And he's trying to unsettle us from our comfortable avoidance of the hard truths of life. So really that's what this book does, at least initially, is it walks us through some very unsettling truths as Solomon tries to kind of just shake us from feeling that, you know, oh yeah, life is great. Hey, I'm an optimist, and I think you ought to be an optimist. I think Christians ought to be optimistic. So I'm not diminishing that. But we should get away from the fact of feeling like I have to come across as if I understand all of this. I know why this is happening. You know, sometimes we may speculate rightly, but not always. I remember when the hurricane hit New Orleans, and among Christians, there was a lot of opinion, sometimes stated with incredible dogmatism, that this was God's judgment on New Orleans because of all the debauchery that goes on there. Now, does debauchery go on there? Yes. But folks, let me tell you what, you and I are pretty debauched too. We're sinners. I mean, you know, God is so holy that sin is sin. I mean, yes, there's degrees of sin and its impact on other people. I get that. But I have no idea if that was in particular God's judgment on New Orleans or what God's reasons were. I don't know. You know, I wish God would lift the curtain and say, here, I'll show you. Here's why I did this. And here's why I did it exactly this way. Here's why I spared these people. Here's why these people died. Here's why this building survived. Here's why this building was destroyed. You know, yes, that would be a real novel and exciting thought. But God doesn't do that. And that's okay. That's okay. Because we know on the basis of his word and on the basis of our experience with him that he's a trustworthy God, that he does all things well, that he has perfect plans. But he wants to kind of shake us a little bit here to say, you know, you don't have life all figured out. And the point isn't so much to figure out life as it is to look to God. You know, let God figure it all out. Now, I've entitled this series, you know, Making Sense Out of Life. You know, you can kind of take that a couple of different ways. But that's really what we want to do, is see what is Solomon going to teach us here about how do we sort through the vaporishness, if that's a word, of life. So what I want to do is just, you know, share several implications of this word Hebel, you know, from these first 11 verses. And the first is this. Clearly, Solomon is teaching us that life is short. You know, vapor of vapors, you know, just, and that vapor of vapor, that's like holy of holies, just a way of intensifying, kind of saying a superlative, you know. And what he's saying is, you know, life is supremely vaporous. You know, something you can't grasp. It's just like that. The essence of vapor is that it is transient, temporary, and vanishes quickly. That's the whole point of that word. You know, think about when you blow out a candle, okay? You first blow out the candle, there's that little bit of smoke that comes up from the wick, and you see it, and you smell it, and if you wave your hand around it, it'll move around a little bit, but, you know, then it's gone. And our tendency is to see life as something we can just really wrap our arms around and keep it all under control, and Solomon says, no, you know what? There's things beyond life. And this life is really incredibly short. You know, and that comes to the gospel idea, obviously, that, you know, don't live your life for this life. You know, look to God, live for him, live for eternity. Eternity is a long time. Vapor is short. This life is just a drop in the bucket. You know, our tendency is to live for the here and now, live for the pleasures under the sun. There's another term that appears about, expression appears about 30 times in this book, and Solomon uses it a lot. And it just means life on this earth in this body. It doesn't mean the wickedness of life. It just has the idea of, you know, while we're on this earth, this is how we live. And our tendency is to try to turn temporary delight into permanent meaning. But Solomon says, you know, what's permanent is, he's going to talk about eternity a little bit later on. It's not what's in the here and now. Now, here's an interesting thing that I actually hadn't given thought to until this week. Do you know what the Hebrew word is that's translated Abel in the book of Genesis? Habel. You look it up, the exact same word as in our text. So if you think about it, now who is Abel? He's the first human being to die. And in fact, we don't even know his name until after he's died. Some people speculate that he was named Habel after quick, transient, and gone after he died. I don't know if that's necessarily the case. I kind of doubt it. But the point is this. Here's an illustration. Abel died unexpectedly, unpredictably, prematurely, in a way that his parents, I am certain, just were aghast at. And his name is what Solomon's talking about here. You know, life is short. It could end this moment, unexpectedly, unpredictably. If you're living for the here and now, you're putting your stock in the wrong account. You're focusing on the wrong things. You know, and again, let me just say, Abel's life had meaning. God honored, you know, recognized him, says he's brought a good sacrifice. You know, so again, Habel doesn't mean meaningless, doesn't mean pointless. It means vaporous, quick, there and gone. You try to grab it and you can't hang on. Life is short, folks. Don't waste the opportunities that God gives you. And in the book of Ecclesiastes, he's going to teach us that. Enjoy life while God gives it to you. It's not a wrong thing to enjoy life. You know, there is no merit in, oh, life is so hard. I'm just suffering for the Lord Jesus. You know, what did Paul and Silas do? They rejoiced in the midst of their suffering. Life is to be about a joyful and glad-heartedness about what God gives us in this life. But it's not about the stuff. It's about the God who gives it. You know, we use expressions like time flies, like the older I get, the faster life goes. Those are all just real-life examples. Those are things that are spoken out of experience that reflect exactly what Solomon is alluding to here. Life is short. Second, life is elusive. Verse 3 says, "What profit hath a man of all his labor, which he taketh under the sun?" The word, you know, the word translated profit is what advantage comes? You know, we tend to view, for example, work, and he's got a lot to say in this book about work, as, you know, bringing benefit to myself. And you know, the profits, the leftovers after all the expenses are paid. And yet, he asks this question, "What profit hath a man of all his labors which he taketh under the sun?" And the rest of verses 4 through 11 really is going to answer that. Or elaborate on that, but the implied answer is nothing. You know, you're going to work your whole life, but in the end, as they say, you can't take it with you, right? You know, and this is what he's saying. He says there's these things that become such prominent aspects of our life. And he's going to later on teach that hard work is a good thing. So he's not saying, you know, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die. Don't work, be lazy. That's not the point. But the point is, If you live for your work and that alone, in the end, you're going to be disappointed because you can't hang on to it. You can't hold fast to it. So this verse speaks of the futility of man's efforts over and against a world that does not yield to his influence. You know, life is a demanding taskmaster, and life is unpredictable, and it is uncontrollable. And life's rewards are uncertain. We tend to think, you know what, if I do this, I should get this in return. We tend to have a quid pro quo mindset. We tend to think a lot about fairness and equity. And usually we're skewing in our own favor on that. But we tend to think about things in terms of I have expectations in response to my work, in response to my efforts. And his point isn't to say that those expectations are wrong. His point is to say that's not really what it's all about. I mean, you work hard, yes, there's remuneration. There's success that may come of that. And enjoy that if God grants that to you. But if God takes it away, you know what? That shouldn't be your undoing. And it may not always be fair. You may be the best employee in your office and get fired anyway. It may work that way. And you shouldn't let that undo you. Because that's just part of this brief temporal life that's here and that's gone. You know, life is like the Energizer Bunny, right? It just, that little bunny pounding on the drum, you know, it just keeps on going. Nothing, it just relentless. And we're trying to kind of get our hands around this, and life is just marching along, and sometimes almost running over us. And we're trying to figure it out. And we're trying to sort it out. You know, you want meaning in life. You want to understand, as I mentioned earlier, why this happens to one and not to another, why things are the way they are. We want to have an understandable correlation to things. That's what Job's friend were saying. If bad things happen, there's got to be an explanation. You know, and those explanations are elusive. You can't wrap your hands around them. You can't get a hold of them. Now, we want everything to make sense. But folks, the reality is life is not simple. It's actually pretty complex. And answers aren't always clear. And nothing is sure apart from the very direct promises of God. But in terms of the arena of life, anything could change in a moment. And we don't like that because we want to be in control. You know, in the book of James, we're familiar with these verses 13 through 15. James instructs, he says, go to now. In other words, hey, listen up. You who say today or tomorrow we're going to go into such and such a city and we're going to stay there a year and we're going to buy and sell and we're going to get gain. We're going to make that profit. Whereas, he says, you know not what shall be on the morrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanishes away. And he says, here ought to be what governs your thinking. If the Lord will, we shall live and do this or do that. We want a plan. We want to control. We want to know. Solomon says, nothing wrong with plans, but realize those plans can change. You know, and you're not going to know. And there are some things, yes, you can try to control. But the reality is you can't even control much of what goes in life. If we could control it, none of us would get COVID, right? If we had control. If we had control, nobody would have cancer, to our thinking, right? Right? We know that to us is a bad thing, an undesirable thing. So if I could choose, I would choose nobody to get that. You know, I would choose, and we think we have the ability to control. And we tend to look to God, asking him to adjust his wishes to our desires. And there's a place for pouring out your heart from the genuine. See, Solomon is not necessarily condemning the struggles and the thoughts that we have. He's helping us to confront that, you know what? We do struggle with these things. We want to be in control. We want to be in the know. We do feel like if I work hard, I should get this. And it's not fair to me if I don't. And he wants us just to be honest about that. And then he wants us to say, now knowing that and realizing that you don't have control, then think about what you're really living for. And think about what you should be living for. And think about how you should be living. Life is elusive. It's hard to sort out. Our plans don't hold. But God can be trusted. And he will take care of us. Number three, life is marked by sameness. And then there's really two aspects to this. There's the idea of monotony and repetitiveness in the daily grind. And then there's the idea that there's nothing novel or new. The expression Solomon uses is nothing new under the sun. You know, folks, I just want to tell you this. In any well-lived life, there is an incredible amount of sameness. In verses 5 through 7, Solomon parallels life to the activities of sun and wind and water. The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose. So the sun comes up, it comes down, it comes back around, comes up again, it just keeps going. Been going like that way before us, it'll keep going way after us. The wind goeth toward the south, and turneth about to the north, and it whirleth about continuously, and the world returneth again according to his circuits. So there's this movement, but it never arrives any place. And, you know, it's not like all the wind gets caught up then up in this direction because it all blows that way. It's just going all kinds of different ways. You can't keep a handle on it. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. There's this seemingly endless stream. Life is like that. It's cyclical. It's repetitive. It's even monotonous. You can change some of the particulars, but in the end, it just creates a new routine. You know, you wake up. You make coffee, you take a shower, you read your Bible, you eat breakfast, you go to work, you come home, you have dinner, you put the kids to bed, you pursue your hobbies, you watch your TV, you go to bed, and then you get up the next morning and you do it all over again. And we can choose to be frustrated by the monotony, or we can choose to see God's good hand in the rhythm of life. It's actually a good thing. Routines are a good thing, as long as they're not ruts. I mean, there's ruts are routines that are going in a bad direction, right? You know, but routines that take us along a good path are good things. We're made. You know, that's why there's right out of the beginning, God created, you know, day and night. And a weekly cycle and an annual cycle. Those are all things that God intends. That is part of life, and we shouldn't be frustrated with monotony. We need to learn to enjoy variety within the monotony. We need to see God's good hand. You know, I said in that list, you wake up, you make coffee. I don't like coffee, but some of you like coffee. Making coffee in the morning, probably for you, that's a good thing. It's a positive thing. It is a routine thing, but, you know, enjoy it. Do you have a hot shower? There's a lot of places in the world where they don't. Enjoy it. Do you have a comfortable bed God has given you to sleep on? A lot of people don't. Enjoy it. You know, Solomon doesn't demean enjoying the gifts of God as long as we don't allow the gifts of God to push out the place of God. You know, as long as our focus is on being grateful to Him for His gifts, not just focused on the gifts and frustrated we don't get the gifts or frustrated because the gifts aren't working out the way that we want them to. Enjoy the gifts that God gives. Enjoy the variety in the midst of monotony. But keep looking to God through it all. Then in the second aspect of this, we need to realize that our day is no different than 3,000 years ago when Solomon wrote this. Verse 4 says, one generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. There's nothing new under the sun. You say, well, what about technology? I mean, when Solomon wrote this, he clearly didn't know about the iPhone 11 Pro, right? He clearly didn't know about that. I mean, that is something new under the sun, right? You know, and I would say, hey, really? And all of those nice features have accomplished what? You know, you go back to the aspiration for communication at the Tower of Babel, and it did not end well. I'm not sure that all of our technological advances necessarily end well. But the point here isn't to say that there may not be new developments. It's not saying there isn't going to be new technology, but the basic desires of the human heart, the basic dynamics of human life, those things don't change. They don't change a lick. And that's what makes the Bible such an amazing book, because it is just as relevant to us as it was 3,000 years ago when Solomon wrote it. Now, you know, admittedly, sometimes we have to sift through the cultural details of things and figure out how this translates into our day, but the fact is, there is nothing new under the sun. Verse 8 says, all things are full of labor. They're full of weariness. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. We're always looking for something new and better, but folks, it's not there. Verse 9 says, the thing that hath been, it is that which shall be. And that which is done, that is that which shall be done. And there's no new thing under the sun. Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new. It hath been already of old time, which was before. You know, his point isn't so much that there's not things that are newer or advances. It's to say this. Everything goes like this. New to old to gone. New to old to gone. Anybody buy a new car? If you owned it for 30 years, are you still driving it? Unless you've restored an old vehicle, probably not, right? New to old to gone. In material things, that's true. And in human life, even, that's true. You know, you're born, you grow, you work, you age, you die. New to old to gone. And Solomon is saying, you know, don't think that you live in a unique day, in a unique circumstance. Don't think that there's some new advance that is just going to make life just so fulfilling and enriching and enjoyable. You know, yeah, there may be short-lived pleasures, but there's nothing new under the sun. And everything that you grasp towards, it's vapor. You may think you got it, but you don't. It's new to old to gone. There's nothing that's really new. Last point here, and I need to wrap this up. Lives and legacies are quickly forgotten. This is where we started, verse 11. There's no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come with those that shall come hereafter. Right? So we are going to be free. Think about this. How many generations before you do you know much about? Most of us probably, we know a lot about our parents in most cases. Sometimes people maybe are orphaned or their parents died very, very young, but for the most part, we know quite a bit about our parents. And most of us know a good bit about our grandparents. But let me ask you this. How much do you really know about your great-grandparents? Let me go one more than that. How much do you really know about your great-great-grandparents? Do you even know their names? Do you know where they lived? Do you know the stories of their life? Now, all this ancestry.com and things maybe has helped us be a little bit more aware, but for most people, three generations is about all we remember. And after that, it's forgotten and it's gone. Mickey Mantle's not even three generations away, and you know, some people have started to forget him. It goes new, old, gone, forgotten. Forgotten. Psalm 103, verses 15 and 16 says, "As for man, his days are as grass, as a flower of the field, so he flourisheth. For the wind passeth over it, and it's gone. And the place thereof shall know it no more." Remember one time I was looking in the cemetery in the place where my grandparents were buried, and I knew sort of what section of the cemetery. So I knew kind of where I was looking. And, you know, and I'm just walking along, and I'm reading names. And, you know, you look at some of the dates and things like that, and, you know, all of those people lived life on this earth, and now they're gone. And some of those grave sites probably haven't had flowers placed on them in a couple generations. Those people are utterly forgotten. You know, that's, and the point isn't to condemn us for forgetting. That's just how it is. You know, really when Solomon is talking about you're going to be forgotten, it's he's not so much taking exception with your ability to accomplish. People have amazing abilities to accomplish, to take the creative minds that God has given us and do amazing things. But what he's challenging is don't think you'll be remembered. It isn't about, you know, people think, well, I got to do more. I got to do something to make it memorable. You know what? I don't care what you do. Given enough time, you will be forgotten. Solomon is saying. And you say, Pastor, this is a really downer message. You know, yes, I get that. And in Ecclesiastes, it's a heavy book. It's got, you know, there's a lot of weighty things there. But there's actually a place for encouragement. And we'll get to that. But let me just say, you know, God says, it isn't life that defines who you are and what's important. It's your relationship with God. So at the end, you know, he's going to say, here's the conclusion of the whole matter. You know, fear God. Obey his commandments. Live for him. You know, don't worry about the ups and downs in life. Don't worry about life being a vapor and the fact that you're trying to grab it and you can't. That's how it is. That is okay. and you know, live with death in view. You are going to die. That's why he says it's better to go to a funeral, to realize the realities of life. Live for eternity. Don't live for what's here and what's now. I want to suggest that Ecclesiastes is the book about faith in the Old Testament. It tells us how a person of faith looks at the world, how he or she can make sense out of life, so to speak. And a wise and faithful person will come to the perspective, will embrace the perspective that Solomon has given us, that all of life is vapor. The life of faith is not grounded in our ability to discern the meaning of everything in our world. It's not about controlling what goes on in your life. Faith is about accepting that God is all we need to live a joyful, fulfilling, God-honoring life throughout all our days under the sun. And so Solomon's going to tell us, stop chasing the wind. Stop grasping for something that can't be grabbed. Life in itself is unable to supply the key questions of identity and meaning and purpose and value and destiny. You're not going to find those in the stuff of life, the circumstances of life. That's not where they're found. Only God holds the key. And folks, God doesn't make copies of that key and give them to you. He holds the key. You know, and you got to trust him. Sooner or later, as a believer, you're going to have to just let God have the key. Let God be God and accept that that's okay. Far better to let God be God than me be God, right? You know, God is the one with the wisdom. God is the one with the power. God is the one who's in control. And to the extent that we have learned true wisdom, our part as Christians then is going to be to fear God and keep his commandments and to receive and use the gifts that God gives us with joy and gratitude. You know, and that means that we enjoy eating and living life together. We love our husbands and our wives and our kids. And we rejoice in all those things. Rejoice in all of God's gifts while just simply trusting in him. We need to cling to God and let him do his will as we journey through the vapor that's this life. That, folks, is the message of this book. That's the wisdom of Solomon. And that's what we'll spend, you know, maybe a dozen sessions just taking sections of this book that flesh those things out in greater detail, and I trust with greater clarity. Father, we're thankful for your word. I'm thankful for just the chance for us to get started in this study, and I know that I've left a lot of things kind of open and incomplete, but I pray that this is certainly a book that is thought-provoking. I pray that your people would go from here tonight with their thoughts spurred and provoked, and maybe with a desire to think these things through in greater depth and spend some time in this book and accept the confrontational things that Solomon says and yet recognize the value in them. And recognize that we can trust you. Bless now as we spend a few moments together in prayer. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. All right, Pastor Mike, if you'd come for prayer requests.